KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What will President Trump's plans to impose tariffs mean for Alaska commerce and economy? How might these taxes affect everything from the price of salmon to the number of construction projects in the state? And what are reciprocal tariffs? There is a lot of uncertainty in how these tit-for-tat tariffs may or may not be leveraged against imports and exports. So what does it mean for the state and country, and how will it affect your personal finances? Economic experts join us to help us understand the implication of Trump's tariffs today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alaskapipeline.com. The Eastern Interior Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will hold a public meeting in Fairbanks, February 19th and 20th at Pike's Waterfront Lodge to develop federal wildlife proposals and discuss other subsistence issues. An outreach session with North Pacific Fishery Management Council regarding chum salmon bycatch will be held in the evening of February 19th. Visit doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Tariff, penalty, tax, however you define it, a tariff imposes additional expense. Why does the president want to use this type of pressure on our international trading partners? What does history tell us about trade wars and how it all shakes out for American consumers? Here to help us understand what tariffs are and who ends up paying for them is Greg Wolf. Greg is the president and CEO of the Alaska International Business Center. And Kevin Berry is with us. Kevin is a professor of economics and the chair of the economics department at the University of Alaska Anchorage, UAA. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for being in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Lori.
Later in today's program, we'll be joined by Cliff White for some perspective on how tariffs could affect fisheries specifically. Cliff is the editorial director for Undercurrent News, a publication focused on the seafood industry. And you can also join us. Do you have questions about what tariffs are designed to do or how they have worked historically? Do you think imposing tariffs could lead to more or less jobs in the U.S.? Call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so let's start with how you both define tariffs. Greg, you said you're not sure most Americans understand how tariffs work, and that could include the president. I'm not an economist, so I'm not completely clear myself. Is it essentially a penalty or tax for either buying from us or selling to us?
Well, what's been proposed are, is a what you consider an import tariff. In other words, we're putting a tariff on goods, say, coming in from China or Canada or Mexico. We are putting a tariff on their products coming into the United States. An import tariff is paid by at the port of entry by the importer. And the importer would be an American individual or an American company. So it's not, I think the misperception has been given, perhaps not on purpose or perhaps for whatever reason, suggesting that somehow China will write a check, that the government of China is going to write a check to America and give us billions of dollars. That will never happen. It's never happened. It's not even possible to happen. Same with Canada or Mexico or any other country. It's an import tariff. And so if I'm importing, I have Greg's import company, and I'm importing Apple phones, which, of course, made in China,
right,
almost predominantly. When I import them, I write two checks. I write one check to the manufacturer in China for the good, for the phone itself, and I write another check to the U.S. Department of Commerce to pay the tariff. So it will be Americans paying the tariff. Okay, so now I've got this higher cost, maybe a 25% tariff. Keep in mind, he said 10% for China, but that's on top of the existing ones. So in some cases, it's like 29 or 30% as of today. So you have a $1,000 iPhone. Let's just say it's a cheap one. And now it's, instead of $1,000, when you would have zero tariff, now it's $1,300.
It would be that much of a tax.
Well, 30% of $1,000 would be another $300. So, in other words, I think Americans think that we're somehow penalizing a foreign country, when in fact, the direct payment of that tariff will be paid by an American company or an American consumer. So let's say Greg's importing company importing these phones. I now have an extra cost of, say, $300. I have a choice. I can either take that out of my profits, or I can try to pass some or all of it on to you buying an Apple phone. So I probably will choose to pass on some or all of the cost. So the American consumer, who is very concerned already going into the election about inflation and higher costs in America, is looking now for looking toward a future now with even higher costs. So I think the misunderstanding for a lot of Americans who I've spoken to all across America, I travel a lot in lower 48, mainly overseas, but I travel a lot and I talk to a lot of people here in Anchorage and in Alaska. I was just in Fairbanks yesterday. They kind of think that China or Mexico or somebody's going to write a check to the American government. That's not how tariffs work. This is an import tariff, and he who imports, that company who imports, is the one who pays the bill.
I see you nodding your head in agreement there. Kevin, give us your take on what tariffs are, and especially why, when something is coming into our country, that we would put additional expense on that when those goods coming in are things that people want, people have asked for. So there's already a price associated with that good coming into our country. Why does penalizing the country sending what Americans have asked for make sense?
Well, as Greg pointed out, we're not actually penalizing the country that we're importing from directly. So the tariff itself is paid by the importer. But there is what Greg alluded to called the incidence of the tax, which is whether or not the added cost of that good gets passed on to the consumer or is sort of eaten by the middleman, right, where they take it out of their profit margin as well. And traditionally, most of that incidence does fall on the final consumer. So it would be consumers who are paying this tax on things that they import from other countries. Mm-hmm. Now, there's typically a couple different motivations for potentially imposing a tariff. You could be doing it as part of a trade dispute, say in retaliation for a different country imposing tariffs. You could do it as a revenue-raising measure. It's been a long time since that was the main motivation for using tariffs, partially because they're distortionary, they make markets less efficient. Or you could also be doing it to try and protect industries, to try and reshore different industries to the United States. Say you impose a tariff on manufactured goods with the hope that the United States will respond by manufacturing more goods domestically once we price out competing countries. Once we make their goods more expensive, we are suddenly more competitive. We've tried that in the past. It has not particularly worked. We didn't see massive growth in manufacturing, for instance, after the 2018 tariffs. But those are typically the motivations for imposing them. And then we've also heard in this latest round that they are being used as a bargaining chip to try and get countries to change policies or reduce their own tariffs in response to us.
When the first Trump administration imposed tariffs on China, the Biden administration came in and kept those tariffs.
Yes.
What was the thinking there, and when do they make sense?
So I can't speculate entirely to what the motivation was, but the idea, the way that I understand it, is that a lot of this was focused on trying to bring jobs back home and protect manufacturing within the United States. Now, we did not see big booms in manufacturing activity in response to tariffs. What seemed to be more successful were the Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure Act, and the CHIPS Act that did a better job of motivating more like factory openings and growth in manufacturing capacity.
Mm-hmm. So, Greg, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, the motivation, I mean, right now there's sort of a mixed message being delivered by the administration. One is that we've been treated somehow unfairly by even our best friends around the world, our allies, let alone our, quote, adversaries or highly competitive nations against us. But the reality is, you know, we've taken sort of pride in the fact that we've moved from over the last 100 years or something, we've gone from an agrarian society to an industrial society, and now we're in the so-called post-industrial society where we say, well, we're not going to be worried about manufacturing, and this is sort of the old way of doing things. We are now a service economy. We have financialized our economy. We export services. We've offshored voluntarily, and this is a real key thing to understand. Some people think that other countries are, quote, stealing our jobs, stealing American jobs. Well, that's not true. The American companies voluntarily have offshored because we're operating in a capitalist system where the idea is that you try to get the lowest cost possible and sell at the highest price possible and maximize profits. That's the whole definition of capitalism. So when you can find out that labor, for example, I've been in China, I've been going back, I work closely with China and the Chinese government on a daily or weekly basis for years. I've been to China many, many times starting in 1989. Always on behalf of Alaska. But no one is stealing our jobs. When Apple's headquartered in what, Cupertino, California, why don't they manufacture the phones in America? They found out that it's cheaper to do it there. For example, auto workers not that long ago in China were making $100 a month. In Detroit, it's almost $100 an hour. You can see the cost differential where it would make sense. Think about the Alaskan situation. You catch the fish in Alaska, maybe in the Bering Sea or God knows where else. You catch it here. It's cheaper to put it, to do the primary processing here. You head and gut it, freeze it, put it in a 40-foot container, ship it all the way across the Pacific Ocean. You have to pay that cost. Then you pay someone there to process the final processing. The higher value added jobs are there. Then they put it in a container, they ship it back to the United States, and you buy it at Costco or Fred Meyer or Safeway. And that's cheaper than actually doing it here.
But now there will be tariffs going both ways.
Okay, that means the consumer is going to have to pay more for Alaska seafood. And I know our guests later will address this more directly.
Yeah.
But that's just the reality. I was just in China in November on a seafood project where we're trying to work with some companies in a particular city to import fresh and live seafood. The problem is we're competing against other nations like Canada and Russia who can basically provide the same seafood. Really, it's almost identical. It's an identical species, actually. So there's not tariffs on Russian crabs or Canadian crabs like that, like they have on Americans. So we're at a price. We have a problem already that we are maybe 25% higher than even a friend like Canada or a, quote, adversary like Russia. But the buyer, they're just looking to buy the same product at the cheaper price.
Of course. If you're just joining us, we are talking today about what tariffs could mean for Alaska's economy and more broadly for the country. In the studio today is Greg Wolf. Greg is the president and CEO of the Alaska International Business Center here in Anchorage. And Kevin Berry is in the studio as well. Kevin is the chair of the economic department at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He is a professor of economics there. Later in the show, we'll hear from Cliff White, who is the editorial director for Undercurrent News, a fishery and seafood industry publication. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So for both of you, Peter Navarro, a senior White House advisor to President Trump, told the New York Times yesterday, or a couple of days ago, that strong economic performance and low inflation during Trump's first term proves that tariffs work. He said, it's not going to be painful for America. President Donald Trump has proven that tariffs work, and they're going to be even more important this second term. Navarro contends that the U.S. market is so important to foreign companies that they'll cut their prices rather than impose and pass tariff costs to consumers. He also contends that car part suppliers will relocate to the United States. Is there, you're shaking your head, Greg, is there any historical evidence to support that has happened at some point? Kevin?
I have not seen evidence that that has happened. So there are recent papers in the American Economic Review, the Journal, Economic Journal and a few other scholarly sources that suggest that the tariffs in Trump's first term led to slightly smaller GDP growth, smaller capital stock, less employment, and actually had negative effects on the American economy in the long run. I have not seen any studies that he's referring to there. I've seen the opposite, but maybe he's aware of research that I have not seen.
All right.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, Peter Navarro. We could talk about him. Let's talk about an Alaskan example, because I think that's what most of our listeners are in Alaska, I presume, and they're interested in what's going to happen to Alaska itself. Take minerals. Most of our mineral industry in Alaska is not done by American companies.
Right.
It's done by Canadian companies. In fact, the state of Alaska government, they do a study every year. They publish their results that show, typically in any given year, 90% of mineral and metal exploration takes place by Canadian companies. They're spending money doing it. American companies are very unrepresented here. So you take minerals, say like zinc, from a particular mine in Alaska, which is the world's largest. It's done by a Canadian company.
The Red Dog Mine you're referring to.
Okay, let's take the Red Dog Mine, for example. They don't do the refining here.
Right.
So they do the mining and the ore, and they ship the ore to where? Canada. So if the Canadians impose a reciprocal tax on the United States, that product, even though it's a Canadian company, it's coming from the United States, so that tariff will apply in Canada if they have that on American exports. So the tariff goes, when it arrives in Canada, there's a tariff. Then they ship the zinc back for American manufacturers, and guess what? There's at least a 10% tariff, maybe more, on that. So it's tariffed possibly twice.
Mm-hmm.
So this is happening in seafood. This will happen in minerals where Alaska tends not to, in almost all cases, does not do the final processing of minerals, seafood, or even timber. Okay? So they have to ship it to another country, and then that country has to ship it back to us.
And I think Greg alludes to an interesting point here, too. Sort of the conflicting motivations for the tariffs are really interesting, because if these are a negotiating tactic, the implication is that they'd be removed if we got what we wanted. If we think about the payback period for building a new factory or opening a new mine, right, the permitting process for a mine alone could be decades long.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we'd reshore, like, jobs in the short term based mm-hmm. on potentially very short-term tariffs, I just don't know any firms that are making decisions on a timeline that short and also spending hundreds of millions of dollars in capital.
So the President Trump, holds up past President William McKinley as sort of the godfather of tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
He was so impressed by McKinley that on the first day of his administration, he released an executive order to reimpose the name McKinley for Alaska's Mount and Denali. Boo to that. Mm-hmm. Trump said McKinley made our country very rich through tariffs. Did he? Was McKinley successful with tariffs, Kevin?
The United States today is the wealthiest it's ever been. Our GDP per capita, our GDP, our real personal consumption expenditure, every measure of human well-being is better today than it was a couple, like, decades ago, 100 years ago. We are wealthier than we've ever been, and a big chunk of that is the post-war, rules-based order, and free trade has allowed us to basically seek the cheapest way to produce the most stuff possible. America is as wealthy as it's ever been.
Keep in mind,
far wealthier. Sorry, I should be correct.
Yeah.
It's far wealthier than it's ever been.
Sorry to interrupt, but keep in mind when McKinley was president, America didn't have an income tax, so that was the motivation for tariffs. Other countries have done that. I've spent a lot of time in the Bahamas. The Bahamas doesn't have a personal income tax, but they have huge tariffs on any imported goods, like an automobile, a new automobile coming into the Bahamas is 100% tariff. So if it costs $30,000 in America, if you buy it, if you're a Bahamian citizen, you buy it in the Bahamas, it's a $60,000 car. This is how they avoid an income tax. But America already has an income tax. And now we're talking on top of that, adding higher and higher tariffs. Now keep in mind, America has created, since World War II, America has created a number of organizations and institutions. One of them is the World Trade Organization, which was founded in 1995. The goal of that, America founded that, was to have a rules-based trade system where everyone who's going to join the WTO and become part of the big trade community in the world, they would have to abide by these WTO rules and regulations. the whole goal of it, you can just Google this and check, the goal of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which China joined in 2000, and there's now 160 countries that have joined this, at the invitation essentially of the United States, was to reduce or eliminate tariff barriers. In other words, promote free trade. What's happening now is quite contrary to that. We also formed the International Monetary Fund after World War II. We had the World Bank after World War II, the World Health Organization later. One by one, we are leaving these organizations or acting contrary to them. The ones that we actually set up, many are headquartered in the United States.
I think also it's worth thinking about how the federal budget is roughly $7 trillion. The United States imported about $3.8 to $4 trillion as of 2023, 2024. So the tariff rates required to replace the income tax and other sources of revenue are over 100%, just off that back-of-the-envelope calculation. And most of the budget for the federal government is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the U.S. military as well. And so these are things that are not easily cut, right?
So I think you were getting to this. How much does the U.S. import annually? And talk a little bit about what that could mean for tariffs for consumer goods.
So it varies by sector. Roughly about 11% of personal consumption expenditure is imported goods.
Okay.
If we think about food, for instance, that can range from about 13.5 to 17%. And that varies also by type of goods. So we import a much larger proportion of like fresh fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. But then if we're thinking about like constructing homes, like if we're talking to the National Association of Home Builders and asking them what they're importing to build a house in Anchorage, on average in the United States, about 32% of appliances are imported, about 30% of softwood lumber, which is used in construction, is imported as well. And so it shows up in different industries to a very different extent. It kind of depends upon what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I would keep in mind, for instance, is that there's not a huge, for instance, coffee growing industry in the United States.
Right.
Basically, all of that is imported. And so some goods will be hit very hard, whereas if we're talking about something that's produced solely in the United States, it may not be hit as strongly.
There's another, I think, part of the tariffs that is changing right now. In fact, I think it may be already implemented for the most part already, just with an executive order from the president. And this has to do with what's called a de minimis exemption from tariffs. De minimis. De minimis is, it's a Latin word, a Latin phrase, which means that the law does not concern itself with trifling matters. So right now, for imported goods, say I want to order a shirt or a blouse from Temu, a Chinese e-commerce company. They have super low prices. In fact, it's a really competitive threat to Amazon.com. Amazon is actually responding with their own version of that. The de minimis exception says if the shipment coming in from a foreign country is $800 or less, there's no tariff. It's just too little to bother with. $800 or less. This has been around for a long time. So this really benefits American consumers, so they have more variety and lower prices and more competition. So if they can't find what they want here for a reasonable price, they can order it from an overseas country. As long as it's $800 or less, there's no tariff, and there's usually less inspection. And it's just the government has more important things to worry about than a $200 or a $100 or a $50 shipment.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the paperwork? Can you imagine how many more employees the federal government would have to have at a time when we have DOGE and we're trying to eliminate federal employees? So this is now going away under the one of the Trump's executive orders.
And so those lower cost
yes.
items will also be tariffed?
Yes. And you can imagine, so who pays that tariff? You when you order a blouse from China. Me when I order a shirt or a wallet or whatever. This really affects China particularly, but other countries as well. 60% of the shipments coming into the United States under the de minimis exemption are from China because of their huge e-commerce presence and their very low prices. And of that, two companies particularly are affected, Temu, which a lot of Americans have learned about recently, Temu, as well as Shein. It also includes Alibaba. Names that people might know.
Sure.
So 60% of these shipments are coming in from China. The rest are coming in from other countries. And of that, 30% are coming from two companies, which would be Temu and Shein. That affects an everyday American citizen. That's a direct pocketbook hit. They're going to have to pay that.
And what are it's so dynamic at this point. We don't know for sure exactly how it's all going to shake out with if maybe the administration will back off, if countries negotiate with the Trump administration. But are either one of you seeing retaliatory discussions from other countries about tariffs that they want to impose if this happens? It's like trade war football, just back and forth. You say you're going to impose 10% tariff, and the country says, well, I'll see your 10 and raise you 20. And how does it end? So what's the discussion with from other nations?
I mean, that's exactly what you'd expect. The sometimes shocking thing about other countries is that they're full of people who respond to things that happen to them. And so we would expect that basically every country that we impose tariffs upon would impose some sort of retaliatory tariff. And historically, those tariffs are usually politically targeted as well. There's evidence, for instance, in the last round of trade war that China, for instance, imposed tariffs specifically on industries in states or regions where they would impact like influential senators or legislators as well. They want to make sure that the pain is felt by the people they feel are making decisions. This is why, for instance, Kentucky bourbon is a target for tariffs, because everybody knows Mitch McConnell is the former leader of the Senate, and he's from Kentucky, and so it's an easy thing to kind of hit. We've already seen that in Canada, where people are talking about boycotting or imposing tariffs on American alcohol specifically, as a way to sort of press that button and try and change policy. But we would 100% expect retaliatory tariffs from every state that, or every nation that we impose tariffs upon.
Yeah, it's already happening.
And before we take a break here at the bottom of the hour, and then we're going to bring on Cliff White, the editorial director of Undercurrent News, fisheries-related publication, to talk specifically about seafood and fisheries industry. But Greg, trade with China. You noted that around 2000, trade was about 100 million. Then in just 10 years' time, there was a significant uptick. Tell us what happened. And then during the first Trump presidency, they imposed tariffs. Alaska lost ground with China.
Yeah. We went from in 2001, 2002, that time period, our exports to China were roughly very small, about 100 million. But this was also a time of dynamic growth in the Chinese economy, and they needed exactly what we have to offer. Alaska, we don't export Gucci watches or Apple phones. We export natural resources primarily. It's our largest. There's nothing even close. We are an export natural resource exporting state. So in the short period of 10 years, we call the Dragon Decade, exports went from 100 million in 2002, 2001, to over 1 billion in 2011. So in 10 years, it grew from 100 million to 1 billion. This is the fastest growth we've ever achieved in Alaska from any country. And those levels have stayed the same. We just received the 2024 statistics. They were just published here a few days ago. Alaska exported a near all-time record to the world, the world outside of the United States. This is foreign exports, foreign exports, not anything we ship to the lower 48. $5.9 billion, essentially $6 billion. This is the second highest level in our history. And of that, of course, since 2011, China has been Alaska's single most important and largest trading partner. Last year, in 2024, the total was $1.5 billion. So for Alaskans, what does that mean? The Chinese buyers send us $1.5 billion in U.S. dollars, and we ship them some rocks and fish. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. That's a pretty nice equation for us to have. Other countries that are affected by these tariffs, Canada usually is our number three or number four trading partner, and they still are. We also do a significant amount of business with Japan and Korea.
Mm-hmm. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will bring on Cliff White, who is the editorial director of Undercurrent News, a fishery publication. In the studio with me today is Greg Wolf, president and CEO of the Alaska International Business Center in Anchorage. And Kevin Berry is the chair of the economics department at the University of Alaska Anchorage. He is a professor of economics there. We will be back in just a minute.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to make a lasting impression? Consider planning a gift as a bequest to this station. Talk to a financial advisor to learn how.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about what tariffs would mean for Alaska's economy and the U.S. economy. In the studio with me is Greg Wolf, President and CEO of the Alaska International Business Center, based here in Anchorage, and also Kevin Berry, a professor of economics and chair of the economics department at UAA, is in the studio with us. And now on the line we have Cliff White. Cliff is the editorial director of Undercurrent News, a fishery and seafood industry publication. Hi, Cliff.
Hey, how are you, Laura?
Good. Thanks for coming on with us today. So if...
Hi, how are you, Lori?
Good. Thanks for coming on with us today. So if I, we were just talking about this a little bit, and...
Highly valued seafood that is sought after across the whole world, and it's also sought out in the U.S. But as you mentioned, yeah, a lot of Alaska seafood products go to China and other countries to be processed, and only to be re-imported into the U.S. So that, if it leaves the U.S. Gets processed elsewhere, there's a high likelihood that it'll get hit by a tariff if it comes back into the U.S. That isn't to say there isn't seafood processing that occurs in Alaska or Alaska seafood that's sent to the lower 48 and processed there, and that would be tariff-free. I think a lot of Alaska seafood executives and folks that run processing or catching operations in Alaska are looking at their supply chains right now and trying to figure out, what price or what tariff percentage does it make sense to start rethinking where they're processing their seafood.
If they are processing, some of their seafood in the U.S., what is that expense compared to when they process in China?
Processing in the U.S. is expensive. Labor is expensive, and equipment's expensive, and there's a whole bunch of regulations that the U.S. follows that other countries don't, and that makes things more tricky for U.S. processors. And there's a lot of factors that go into deciding where to process seafood. A lot of salmon in Alaska is caught and processed in Alaska, but that sector has really struggled lately. The price of salmon has gone way down, a couple major processors have closed. I'm sure you guys have covered that at Alaska Public Radio, and people are really looking at the sector. People in the industry are looking at the sector, not knowing what's going to go on or happen, even without the tariffs being a factor. Now, with the tariffs, is it going to favor Alaska seafood and the U.S. domestic seafood industry, or is it going to throw curveballs into the mix that are going to really disrupt this kind of tenuous supply chain that we have now? And what's going to happen with that, we don't really know.
What do you hear from the industry here, both vessel owners and processors, about their concerns?
Everyone's concerned. There's a lot of uncertainty, obviously. Seems like every day there's a new tariff announcement. China is the main processor of Alaska seafood, so you know people are already looking at moving their processing to a third country, maybe Vietnam, or looking to bring it back nearshore is how they call it to the U.S. or it used to be Mexico, but now Mexico is facing tariffs, the point of these tariffs, or at least ostensibly one of the points, is to bring U.S. manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. or back to where they were 30 years ago, or longer, where we had a robust domestic manufacturing sector. And so that's one of these objectives of putting these tariffs on, according to the Trump administration. So whether that happens or not, it'll be interesting to see. The big question is, will U.S. consumers pay more for seafood? Because that's what it's going to ultimately, whether there's they're getting food that's been, or seafood that's been processed in China and brought back, or processed in the U.S., it's going to cost more with these tariffs.
And with all this uncertainty in kind of roiling things at this point, how does that affect the business plans for vessel owners and processors? It's been a tough go for them over the last few years as it's been. Spring fishing isn't far off. How can they make plans?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's tough, but the seafood industry always talks about how resilient it is, and it's really getting tested right now. The seafood industry prides itself on being quick-acting and resilient. I'm sure if you ask any Alaskan fishermen, you know, they'll talk to you about, how they've survived a lot of tough times. Alaska has really established a very solid name and recognition and appreciation for Alaska products all over the world. So, you know, you lean on that. But with reciprocal tariffs, you know, these trade wars, who knows what other countries will do in terms of raising tariffs on U.S. goods. So even export markets may struggle. So where does all this product go? Ultimately, you know, do fishermen retrench? Do they catch less? Do they try and find new markets? Do they try and double down on the U.S. market? I think that's what everyone's thinking about right now.
And Cliff, one more question for you here. How, beyond the expense added to fish and seafood directly, how else do you see tariffs potentially affecting the fisheries industry?
Mm. Well, I mean, you've got tariffs on aluminum, and so that could affect cans, equipment for processing. That's not necessarily made in the U.S., so that could be hit with tariffs. The biggest thing to keep an eye on, and this is a new development, is these talks with Russia. There's all of a sudden direct negotiations between the Trump administration and the Russian government. There's currently a full ban on Russian seafood imports into the U.S., and that includes Russian seafood processed in third countries like China, which, you know, China is processing a ton of Russian seafood as well. And that loophole was closed in the past few years. No small thanks to Alaska's congressional delegation. But if that's on the negotiating table, that ban gets removed, Russian seafood is the most directly comparable to Alaska in terms of products. Mm. King crab, whitefish, salmon, you name it. It's the same ecosystem. It's producing the same wild seafood. So all of a sudden, this major competitor that's been removed from the U.S. market might all of a sudden, you know, face a much removal of the ban in a very advantageous situation in competing against Alaska seafood coming into the U.S. So that's something else to look for.
All right. Well, along those lines, you mentioned the expense of potentially cans for canned salmon. Kevin, the 25% tariff on steel and aluminum, those are scheduled to go into effect on March 12th. Is there any evidence, that tariffs, steep tariffs on foreign steel would result in more American production of steel, or will it just mean higher prices for construction?
I think, again, this is sort of an uncertain question because it depends upon timelines. If you're building a new foundry to generate steel, thinking about 10, 20 years maybe as a timeline for payback. And so if you expect those tariffs to be lifted because they're also a negotiating tool, I have a hard time seeing there's a lot of reshoring. What we may see, though, is that if we impose these tariffs, we make the input prices for everybody who uses that steel higher. Right, so anybody who is planning a large construction project that depends upon steel suddenly faces costs for the materials that are 10 or 25% higher than they were previously. And this can also impact things like auto manufacturing. Right, so if we, for instance, we're building cars in Detroit and we are moving those parts back and forth across the border with Canada, every single time they cross that border, they have to pay the tariff. That then is going to basically reduce manufacturing jobs because a lot of those things will no longer pencil out and we just won't be competitive. And I think both in seafood and steel and other things, it's worth remembering that these are large and global commodities markets, which means that there's a lot of substitutes out there, as we just heard. But on top of that, some of these things are built to very specific tolerances. So if we're speaking about steel, right, there are potentially, there's a global commodities market, but there's maybe a very specific kind of steel that needs to be produced that's maybe only made by very few manufacturers. And again, in order to get an American company to specialize in building one specific type of steel, I'm skeptical.
And Greg, I want you to weigh in here too, but I want to expand this a bit to right now there's a lot of federal infrastructure and inflation reduction funds that are frozen, that there was a lot of renewable energy money that was going to rural Alaska. Those pots of money, those tranches are also frozen right now. What happens if that money then eventually is unfrozen and people can start these projects again, what will happen to the amount of money they would have had compared to what they will have in a tariff scenario? Because they probably haven't ordered things if things aren't frozen right now.
It won't go as far. So I'm actually working with a contractor on getting my roof repaired right now, and we're trying to get the materials orders in immediately. We might be a little bit too late because we may just not do the job if the tariffs raise the price by a significant amount, right? Mm-hmm. And so that money for all those infrastructure acts and everything else is not going to go as far as it would have previously gone.
Yeah.
Think about talking about steel. Alaska's not involved in that. We're just a buyer of it. We don't produce any. But think about an Alaska natural gas pipeline made of what? The pipe's made of what? Steel?
Not wood.
Right? And frankly, you know, it's a huge quantity. It would be one of the largest purchases, just like when we built the oil pipeline. This was a very, very large purchase for one project. You know, 800-mile project of nothing but pipe. America no longer has the capability to build that quality of steel to that tolerance in that quantity. So in reality, they would have to partner with a foreign company, maybe in Europe or maybe in Asia, to build that pipe, for that pipeline to be built. Tariffs, whether it's from a friendly country like, say, Japan, or maybe a European country, the tariffs will just make that project, I think they estimated at about $40 billion roughly. It's sort of a moving number. It's going to have to be more expensive if those tariffs remain in place at that time when a go decision is made. So there's really strong impact on Alaska. And this is why I'm encouraging our delegation in Washington and even our legislature here to really think about an Alaska first policy, or, you know, rather than an America first policy, because sometimes they are in contradiction to each other. And we know that. I mean, the state of Alaska sues the federal government on any number of occasions for policies that they've set up which hurt Alaska. So I'm hoping and suggesting to our delegation in Washington to follow an Alaska first policy rather than an America first policy, or maybe the policy of a certain party or a particular politician. Think what's best for Alaska. That's why we hired them, by voting for them.
All right. On that note, we are going to take one more quick break as we continue our discussion about what tariffs could mean for Alaska's economy as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line One, Your Health Connection. Join our hosts as they discuss the health topics that matter to Alaskans with their guests and live callers. Email questions before, during, or after the live broadcast to line1@alaskapublic.org. That's Line One, Your Health Connection, weekly on your local public radio station.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation in our final, about 15 minutes here. 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. The Alcan Highway, semis with goods bound for Alaska, must pass through Canada. Could Canada impose additional tariffs on those items simply just passing through on the highway?
Yes. They imposed restrictions on the Alcan during COVID. The highway runs through Canada, where Canadian law is the law. They can do pretty much whatever they want.
Okay, so that could be just a truck with goods from the lower 48 could have additional expense imposed on it.
They could even close it entirely.
You keep in mind, foreign trade policy sometimes mirrors foreign policy in that foreign policy is driven by quid pro quo. Let's say we're upset with the Russians and we force them to close their consulates here, or we throw out a couple people from their embassy. What do? The next day, they throw out the same number of people from our embassy and they close our consulates, that type of thing. So that's quid pro quo. Tit for tat is another way of saying it. This sometimes is true in trade policy. If you do this to us, then we're going to do this to you. It's very rarely one way. And I've been involved in trade. This is my 37th year doing trade for Alaska. I've seen a lot of tariff wars and even trade wars. Tariff wars, there's a bigger version of that, which is an absolute trade war. We're not quite at that point, but we're in a tariff war. And
do you see this tipping into a trade war?
Yeah, we're getting very close to it now. We've already set up export controls, which is a form of a trade war, where we say to, like, one of our most successful semiconductor plants, NVIDIA, one of our top semiconductor makers of very high-end, high-powered semis, we say there are certain ones, your really good ones for quantum computing and AI, you cannot ship to China. That's an export control preventing an American company from actually, forget about tariffs, they're not even allowed to export it. And this has been done with Russia. It's been done with China. And those countries, you're actually, in a way, we are forcing, we're very worried. Our military's worried, and others are worried about a closer alliance between Russia and China.
Well, and now we have, Europe is steamed up at us because the Trump administration is meeting with Russia, cut out Ukraine, cut out Europe from these table. They're saying it's shuttle diplomacy. They're going to go back and forth. But Ukraine said, you know, don't make an agreement without us. And Europe is meeting outside of the U.S. How could this current situation, this tension, also exacerbate the problem with trade with what have been our ally countries? And what kind of a chilling effect could this have?
Well, let me just jump in and I'll pass it over to the dear professor. But we've already seen retaliatory measures from China. Just moments after, I mean, they were anticipating these, of course, based on the previous administration in 2016. So they immediately announced a series of retaliatory measures, including 15% tariff on coal and liquefied natural gas, 10% tariff on crude oil, agricultural machinery, large cars, and pickups. These tariffs took place on February 10th. Additionally, they've announced an antitrust probe against Google. They've added two American companies, Illumina and PVH, which owns Calvin Klein and Tom Hilfiger, industries.
Tommy Hilfiger.
There you go.
Yeah.
What you said. And also other retaliatory measures. A very important one, restrictions on the export from China of critical minerals. Talk about rare earth elements, which China currently controls 90%, many of which are used in production of high-tech products. We cannot make a missile, an airplane, a cell phone, your computer, a solar panel. We cannot make them. And one of those ones, a key one, is tungsten. Tungsten is a very high strength metal. There are only a few countries in the entire world that produce this. China's one, Russia's another, Canada's another. The interesting thing about the tariffs that they've already announced, they're very selective, right? I said coal, natural gas, things like that, oil. Guess what? All of these things they can get from what country? Russia. So we're actually forcing China to go into bed with Russia. And this is something that we're concerned about. That we're already seeing joint military operations off the coast of Alaska on air and sea. But we're forcing them to work together in a non-dollar basis. They're sort of trying to leave the dollar system. And they're buying now and selling in each other's currencies, the Chinese yuan and the Russian ruble. They're trying to avoid, and Iran and other countries are getting into this sort of area where they've seen what happened to Russia, where all the sanctions, the confiscation of homes and airplanes and yachts by Russian oligarchs, they've seen what's happened. And they don't want this to happen to them. So they are finding substitution to the American dollar and to the American goods.
Kevin, I want you to jump in here, too, and go ahead and reflect on that. But then I want to talk a little bit about NAFTA and what happened after NAFTA.
Yeah, so I think it's worth mentioning, right, that tariffs are often political, right? They are motivated by political concerns, right? When we talk about different restrictions and policies against Russia, for instance, their response to their invasion of Ukraine and the war crimes and everything else that they've committed there and the geopolitical situation. But when we talk about previous trade restrictions, they were typically motivated by things like national defense as well, is a very common explanation. And so when we talk about microchips, right, there's been this move to restrict the access of other countries to very advanced microchips manufactured by the United States because they're used in drones, which are a central piece of modern warfare. But some of the most successful policies for promoting like the manufacturing of those chips in the United States are things like the CHIPS Act, which was bipartisan and subsidized the development of large factories in the United States in order to manufacture these things, like the recently built factory in Arizona by I had the name on the top, by Intel on the top of my
tongue.
There
you go.
Right, and so we've seen these sort of national defense goals be used before as motivation for trade policy, and it's hard to say in those cases how useful it is. What's strange is when we start to use those national defense motivations when we're talking about Canada, who's been our ally for the last 100, 120 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the just to add on to, just to further what he just mentioned, The tariffs are now being used. I mean, tariffs have been around for a long time, but they're now being used like someone handing out candy at Halloween. I mean, just tariffs on everybody, on everything. But they're not always used for anything having to do with the economy or even to an extent not national defense. For example, one of the reasons why he's putting the tariffs on Canada and Mexico is that they're not doing enough to stop the flow of fentanyl, or they're not being strict enough on immigration. This is a non-trade issue. So a person who feels very strongly about weaponizing the Department of Justice or something like that now is weaponizing trade policy and making it a blunt force bully playground bully to accomplish other things having nothing to do with the economy or trade.
Let's get a caller in here very quickly. Carl is in Homer. Hi, Carl. We only have a couple minutes here.
Hello. I was wondering, you know, I'm a boat builder and a manufacturer here in Homer, and I was wondering, perchance, if we could have some kind of tariff-free or duty-free program for Arctic nations to network and work together and develop our common northern resources, such as steel from Norway and aluminum from Iceland, you know, being shipped to the polar nations at a duty-free so that we'd improve our manufacturing. So that's kind of, hoping that, you know, opening up the Northwest Passage, we can stimulate that by developing trade between our Arctic nations.
It's a lovely idea, but our president would have to approve of such an agreement, isn't that correct?
Yes, and I think this brings up an interesting point, too, in that there's another inefficiency that tariffs introduce, which is now it becomes very valuable to lobby your elected representatives and whoever makes decisions on who gets an exemption from tariffs. And so now companies, instead of focusing on ways to find the lowest cost way to produce goods, also have to focus on hiring a lobbyist to try and get themselves an exemption for the good, the materials that they purchase from overseas. And also they are probably lobbying to raise tariff rates on their competitors as well.
Do either of you see any bright spots here? We've been talking about this in pretty gloomy terms. Are there any benefits to this idea?
Well, I mean, in theory, I can understand the theory of the current administration. I'm not a political person. I'm not involved in politics at all. Whether Biden's doing it or Trump's doing it or anyone else, Bill Clinton's doing it or Ronald Reagan's doing it, that's not a real issue for myself or our organization. We're just trying to figure out what's best for Alaska. And when you tariff high tariffs on two of our top trading partners who have been very good to Alaska and purchased more than we buy from them and who invest in Alaska with their dollars, we have to worry about what our trade. Keep in mind, in 2018, when Trump introduced the first, in his first administration, the first tariffs against China, our exports to China dropped almost $250 million. It dropped to $250 million lower. So it was an immediate hit on the Alaska economy. That means people got laid off. That means we didn't sell as much. So there is a direct impact on these things happening. It's not in theory, it's in reality.
And Kevin, in our final minute or two here, I'd like you to reflect on what the bright spots may be, but if we have time, the NAFTA agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement, I remember when it was passed hearing critics say, oh, hear that draining sound, that's your jobs going to Mexico and other countries. What is the fallout there?
I mean, that was true for some people, right? Sure. There are definitely sectors in the United States that got hit by NAFTA where they lost employment, they lost factories. And we've found in the past couple of decades through economic research that a lot of those losses were sticky, too, local economies didn't adjust immediately and people didn't immediately find new jobs like theory would suggest they should. But I do think, yes, there are always winners and losers in tariff policy and in trade policy. The losers broadly will be consumers in the United States and anyone who uses imported goods to manufacture things that they sell to others. Those people will all be losers, which is pretty much all of us. The winners are a much smaller group. It's any industry whose competitors are now slightly less competitive because of those tariffs. So if you're a domestic producer of steel that only sources all your materials from within the United States, you maybe are slightly more competitive. Now, it's not clear if that's going to show up in wages for your workers or in expansion or just more profit to owners. But there are those folks who will benefit from this. And I think, like I said, one of the complications is that some of those benefits are going to be distributed based on who is able to most effectively lobby for exemptions for the stuff they buy and high tariffs on the things they sell.
And in just a few seconds, what's your gut tell you? Is this just a negotiating tactic to make countries kind of bend to the will of the U.S.?
Well, that's already happening. I mean, Canada's made some changes. Mexico agreed to send thousands more troops to the border and all that. Whether that will have really any impact is remains to be seen.
Right.
But
okay.
In my 37 years, I've never seen a winner. I've always seen this as a lose-lose proposition.
My gut is that I have no idea because it seems like things change day to day. But if the United States word is now less reliable, there are costs to that as well that are hard to quantify.
Thanks to my guests, Greg Wolf, President and CEO of the Alaska International Business Center, Kevin Berry, Professor of Economics and Chair of the Economic Department at UAA, and Cliff White, Editorial Director for Undercurrent News. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Wesley Early helped us out. And I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next Tuesday. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
This program was brought to you by Jim and Shirley Brown's Apartments, located in Sand Point above Trident Seafoods and the Boat Harbor. Featuring two-bedroom apartments on a month-to-month basis For more information, call Jim Brown at 386-6050.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, small craft advisory through Wednesday. Today, southeast winds 25 knots,